Welcome to Cider Chat. In this episode, it's all about cider and marijuana.
Going up, going up.
Hello, this is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. I am thrilled to be sharing with you this featured presentation that was pre-recorded at CiderCon 2020 in Oakland, California. But before we go there, let's go to a wee bit of news out and about in Ciderville. For all the folks who are checking out Cider Chat for the first time, welcome to an amazing landscape of people, places, and good libations. And for all the regular listeners who are subscribed and heard last week's episode and was going, what is going on at minute 217? That's kind of how I kind of track things down to the minute while I'm editing, and you were hearing like a double voice thing. Well, that was a glitch. It has since been fixed. Thank you for the folks who were contacting me saying, hey, Rhea, that's what's going on there. I had no idea. Last week's episode was all ready to be uploaded. I said, great. I pressed, you know, this and that little button while it was all like formatting, and then walked away and I unplugged an external hard drive and I kind of lost it all, which sent me back hours. And I mean hours. So it was amazing that I got the episode up. And as such, I thought I listened through, I guess a version that was correct didn't go up. And, you know, just to make a long story short, it could be kind of a little bit crazy here in the Cider House production room for Cider Chat. Wouldn't you agree, Mr. Quince?
Roger that.
Yes, indeed, roger that. Of course, it's been a little bit quiet because the rest of the talking palms, like Perry Pear and the Medlars, are still hanging out in the orchard and kind of cleaning up the tail end of some very high winds that are going on out there in our perfect spot of Ciderville. Very, very high winds, and things getting kind of bumbled around. So I'm sure they'll be around for the 250th episode coming up, and be a party in the Cider House then. But you know, these things happen, and so thanks for bearing with me. And if you downloaded it and you want to hear the correct version, well, you could just go to social media because I put it everywhere. I just love the fact that folks sent me in a little bit of a sing-along that was Brian Rutzen and Ambrosia Borowski, both based in Chicago, fantastic cider people. And most recently, people would know them via the Northman Cider Bar, which is now closed and kind of transformed, and they're moving on, but still hanging out in the cider realm. So speaking of that, we're just going to take another little, piece of their heart here, I suppose. A pause, and then I'll be right back.
There's a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-dum, ba-dum.
I just love that. Again, that was Ambrosia and Brian, and I want you both to know now that you are officially in the folder titled Great Transitions for Cider Chat. So you never know when you're going to be popping up again. You are eternally out there in the airways of this here podcast and all part of Ciderville. Hugs and kisses to you both. All right, moving forward, I want to talk about something that happened this weekend. It just fills my heart. You know, there is always 99.9% of the things happening in the world are really, really good. Let's start at that platform and just remember that. That is my kind of measurement. And then it's like that little point percent that we could really focus on. So I don't have time for that point percent. I have time, though, for the 99.9% of positivity that keeps on spreading everywhere. And that happened this weekend when I was conversing with my friends, Colleen and James. They are Duck Chicken. They're based in South London, and they're just amazing people and fine cider makers. And so I was hearing about how they're bottling their Perry. They got all these pears from Broom Farm out in West Country, and that's part of the Ross & Wye Cider & Perry Company. And they picked these pears from a variety called Moorcroft. That's spelled M-O-O-R-C-R-O-F-T. And evidently, this orchard of pears hadn't been picked in like the past 6 or 7 years. So it was a really big deal that they have this Perry, and they're obviously feeling really good about it. So I feel really good about that for them. And evidently, there was a tank of this also at the Ross on Wye Cider and Perry Company too. But unfortunately, evidently, via a tractor, one of those tanks got knocked over, which is really, I just, my heart, oh, that's a hard one. That's hard news, I know. But perseverance will move forward. And so, aw, both of these groups, both Ross on Wye Cider and Perry Company is part of the Cider Going Up campaign, and Colleen and James have been also supporters of Cider Chat via the Patreon page at Cider Chat. So thank you so much, Colleen. Thank you, Ross on Wye Cider and Perry Company. Thank you, Spacetime Mead and Cider Works. Thank you, Process MNR Analysis. Thank you, Insider Japan. Thanks to these like commercial productions who are supporting, primarily all outside of the U.S., supporting this podcast, which embraces so much of the U.S., like we are going to be doing this week. So if you're in that neighborhood where you really love cider and you want to lift it up in one neighborhood so all neighborhoods lift up, well, then do consider becoming a patron of this podcast. So you could check it out at the Cider Chat page for Patreon, spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. Just Google it or go to ciderchat.com. You'll find that link there. And stay connected. That's really what it's about. More now than ever, it's all about staying connected. I would hate to, not even have crickets on the airways talking about cider. And we are approaching our 250th episode. That just blows me away. All right. Another pause here, and then we're going to be going into the featured presentation, and I'll talk more about that when I come right back.
Walking through the orchards.
The following presentation was pre-recorded at CiderCon 2020 in Oakland. CiderCon is an annual trade conference put on by the American Cider Association. This presentation was conducted by attorneys Mark Cerini and Alva Mather. The full presentation title was Current Regulatory Status of Marijuana and CBD Beverages. For obvious reasons, this talk is geared towards an American audience, but at the same time, there are many territories around the world that have legalized use of cannabis, and probably some that are really hoping to do so. In fact, in the U.S., most recently, the world is changing quite quickly around cannabis use. In November of this year, just a few weeks ago, like 2 weeks ago, 4 more states legalized the use of cannabis here, raising the total from 11 earlier this year to 15 states. So the obvious question that lends is, well, can you fuse cannabis into cider? That is something that we're seeing in other products. We're seeing CBD labels everywhere. Mark and Alva will be talking about that. And I did find this a very fascinating discussion because it's a billion-dollar operation and just, you know, rising and rising in the U.S. on the revenue from growers of marijuana and producers of these like byproducts, kind of deriving it out of it, the pot plant itself. So let's head to that next. You're going to first hear Mark and then Alva. It's a fantastic presentation. There is a PowerPoint presentation. I have posted that at the Cider Chat Patreon page for patrons. So if you're a patron of Cider Chat, you can look at that. It's up there now. And if you're not a patron, well, then become one. Why not? Help support this chat worldwide. This PowerPoint presentation will be going live to everyone. It will go public via the Cider Chat Patreon page on December 25th at 4:20 p.m. Now let's head to this feature presentation once again with Mark Cerini and Alva Mather of the McDermott, Will & Emery Law Firm, based in Washington, D.C.
My name is Mark Cerini, and with me is Alva Mather. And for those of you who know me, I've been speaking here for a while, and I'm now in a transition, handing over my practice to Alva as I move on to some hopefully more interesting endeavors in the near future. I don't plan to disappear, but my big firm law days after 25 years are going to transition to something new. So this is the probably last time I'll be here at CiderCon as a McDermott Will & Emery partner. I'm going to be a friend of the firm for life, but I'm going to be doing some other things. Fortunately, between Alva and Beth Hetef, who should raise her hand here, also at McDermott, you guys, for those of you who are clients, are going to be in great shape. So today, without then further ado, we're going to talk about the state of cannabis and CBD and alcohol beverages and try to relate that to the cider industry. And it's kind of an interesting area of law because, as a lawyer, this is one of those places, a little bit like direct shipping was a few years ago, where the disjoint between what the law is and what activity is going on in the market is enormous. So I'm going to start with the basics. Kind of think of this presentation as a bit of a funnel. I'm going to start with the very high-level background, and then I'm going to hand it over to Alva to get into some of the more practical nitty-gritty, particularly on CBD, which I think is the area where people are going into. Show of hands, does anyone know of, I've seen plenty of beers that are infused. TTB has sent cease and desist letters. But anybody try that on cider? On hard cider, interesting, okay. Yeah, because I've seen wine, I've seen beer, I haven't seen spirits yet, and I hadn't personally seen cider, but it doesn't surprise me at all. So start with the following, which I think is an interesting paradox that we have. As you know, and this is Civics 101, we are a federal system. So as a federal system, you've got actual sovereignty residing in the states. This is not one where the states are a mere subdivision to do the will of the federal government. They have their own legislatures and their own police powers to enact laws. As part of that, the states, as you know, and here we are in California, have led the way to legalizing recreational cannabis in about 11 states now, and then medical cannabis in a heck of a lot more. The federal government has lagged. And in some ways, intellectually, that's a very different perspective than what you had with alcohol, where national prohibition repeal happened, and then the states kind of scrambled to catch up, passing their own legislative enactments. Now, many of you would say, wait a minute, I kind of remember from civics class that even though the states had sovereignty, federal law is, preempt state law, or can preempt state law, and that's absolutely true. But you also have this curious phenomena which is driven by the politics of cannabis, which is that although the federal government theoretically can say, well, look, I don't care if it's legal in the state, we're going to prosecute you, the reality is that political considerations, even under the Trump administration, have kept the federal government largely at bay, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But also remember that all of this is a creature of politics and discretion, which means just saying, hey, you guys have been allowing, Colorado's been cannabis legal for what, 6-7 years, clearly you can't prosecute me, I'd be the first one. Oh no, it doesn't work that way, right? If you just have the exercise of discretion by the government, that can evaporate overnight. So any discussion of this area, particularly with federal law, has to start with the Controlled Substances Act. And the Controlled Substances Act dates back to 1970, and it was where the government took drugs and put them into different schedules based on what their use was and what their control was going to be. And the big bad category was Schedule One. A Schedule One drug is something that has a high propensity to be abused and has no known medical benefits. Now, what's interesting about that second part is little pieces of, and the statutory term is marijuana, it's not cannabis. I will typically use the word cannabis, but we'll use those interchangeably. Little pieces of the plant are being carved out of Schedule One and put into other schedules as medical research finds that they do have very, very significant medical uses. But the default is, under federal law still, that cannabis is a Schedule One controlled substance. So it's bad. Now, there are also two, and we're going to talk about this a little later, but there's also two primary active components, and THC being the one that was so fun in college, THC itself as an element is on Schedule One as a controlled substance. So what does that mean? Well, bad things theoretically happen to those who traffic in a Schedule One controlled substance, specifically criminal penalties, and exactly what penalties will depend on a lot of factors, even under the sentencing guidelines, which nowadays are just guidelines. They're not as binding as they were because of some Supreme Court case law. But those guidelines, based on quantity, can quickly lead to life imprisonment. That's pretty scary. And then on top of it, you've got the forfeiture laws. The forfeiture laws say that if you take some, you have some sort of property that's used in the commission of a crime, or you have the proceeds of a crime, the government gets to take it away. So in theory, this is a very scary proposition for a commercial business. Now, many people say, well, that's okay. I'm going to be really smart, and I'm going to be the guy or gal who simply takes my de-alcoholized cider, ships it off to a third party, and the third party infuses it. I'm good, right? Well, remember, think about, and the analogy is, right, crack cocaine. If you're the person who just buys the baggies for the dealer, that's all you do, you buy the baggies, but you know that you're selling it to the dealer and the dealer's putting the crack rocks in there, you could be prosecuted for aiding and abetting, or you could become part of the criminal enterprise, or the scariest of them, RICO, right? A racketeering-influenced or corrupt organization. And that not only puts you in harm's way criminally, but it also has a civil liability component if your criminal enterprise harms somebody. So again, in theory, there's some serious stuff here. Well, come on, Mark, that's not really how it works. And so this part now we're going to disclaim. It's just like the securities law that past occurrences does not guarantee future results, right? But up until now, there has been the exercise of prosecutorial discretion. If you are a big bad prosecutor, you still get to decide, well, I'm going to go after this case, but not this case, because this set of facts is not as bad as that set of facts. Prosecutors do that all the time. But in the case of cannabis, and of course, part of this gets influenced by politics, in the case of cannabis, there has been a much more systematic exercise of prosecutorial discretion. Now, the Obama administration, right after Colorado and Washington went legal, said, okay, we are going to create this, what was called there was a series of memos that culminated in something called the Cole Memo. And the Cole Memo said, unless one of these eight aggravating factors is present, at least one, and more so if there are multiple factors present, if you are complying with the state legal system, we're not going to prosecute you. So it was kind of a guideline. If you keep your nose clean, you stay within state law, and you don't do one of these eight things, you're okay. And those eight things, you could probably guess what they are, right? Sales to minors, diversion into a state where it's not legal, involvement of some sort of organized crime, involvement of some sort of terrorist organization, et cetera. So, okay, that was the rule. Well, of course, Jeff Sessions, the original Trump Attorney General, he was a major marijuana critic. He hated he was probably the most anti-cannabis guy in the entire Congress. So he comes in, but surprisingly, it takes him a year before he officially repeals the Cole Memo. But he finally does, and he moves away from that. So, here comes the feds going after the dispensaries, right? Wrong. Politics kick in, I think, and if you look at the prosecutorial discretion being exercised by the Trump administration, it really didn't change from the Obama policies, which is there has to be something really bad going on in addition to mere trafficking in cannabis in compliance with state law for the federal government to intervene. And if you look at then William Barr, during his confirmation, he made it clear that prosecuting state legal cannabis was not going to be on his radar screen. Then you have the other part of the protection, which is as follows. Everybody knows, right, this is again Civics 101, that Congress passes laws that are substantive, right? You can do this, you can't do that, but then Congress has to spend the money every year to fund various programs. So if we're going to do that, that's the substantive law. Well, you also have to pay for how you're going to do that. Those are the annual appropriations bills, which of course now have become much more visible to the public because of things like government shutdowns. Well, one vehicle that Congress often uses where there's not consensus to really change the law, but there's starting to be consensus, is appropriation restrictions. And so for the last five appropriations bills, the sixth one's still in the works, Congress has said, if you are doing something with medical marijuana in compliance with state law, Department of Justice, you can't touch that. And there's actually case law affirming that indeed that's what they did. They in effect immunized state legal medical operations from federal prosecution. Not because the law has changed, but because the Department of Justice can't use any resources. The latest spending bill, and last year they tried this as well, would extend that to all state legal cannabis operations, both medical and recreational. Stay tuned on that. But you can see that the consensus for legalization or at least decriminalization is clearly there. So now a little bit on nomenclature, because this is where, and I'm about to sit down and you're going to get somebody really smart up here telling you about stuff rather than me just prattling on. But there's an important distinction now that starts to arise, and that's between THC, tetrahydrocannabinol. I remember it was so cool in college when I figured, you know, when you learn that word, it's like, oh man, right? Oh yeah, yeah. Remember also, like even back then, there was like, and I'm an old fart, there was that one place in like Alabama or Mississippi that sold government, grew government legal weed. Once in a while, you'd have some guy visiting from some other college, like, dude, I got government weed. And it was always bad, too. It was never good. I don't think they weren't nearly as good as the guys up in Humboldt. But anyway, but THC is the active ingredient. And actually a little interesting factoid, but very relevant to a lot of the policy discussions, is that the stuff that we all enjoyed in college, at least people my age enjoyed in college, was just so wimpy compared to, it was like, you know, it was like Bud Light to a double IPA when it comes to THC levels in current cannabis. And that's driving some interesting policy discussions because particularly with edibles, some of the levels are so high that, pardon the pun, boy, there's gonna be a lot of puns in this one. You get the best one though, and you know which one I'm talking about. The levels are so high that the opportunity for really, really devastating, you know, either errors and accidents or even arguably poisoning is there. And then you've got CBD, cannabidiol. Cannabidiol, and when I was in college, like, well, what's cannabidiol? Like, nobody was talking about it until, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. But CBD is the non-psychoactive, or at least largely non-psychoactive portion of marijuana, which has one very well recognized medical use, which is against seizures, and Alva's going to talk about that in a minute. But then it also has a number of at least anecdotally reported benefits, including anxiety relief, which is significant. And I know that right now there's a lot of interest in CBD because, and I think this is about, well, I think I have two more slides, right? But what's really happened is that you have this division now, which has peeled off the plant that is very good for producing CBD from the plant, even though it's, I think, scientifically more or less the same plant. But from the beginning, the definition of marijuana in the CSA excluded the seeds and stalks, sterilized seeds and stalks. And everybody remembers from college, right? If all you had was seeds and stalks left, it was like, ah, dude, no buzz tonight. All we got is stalks left. So not a lot of THC in the seeds and the stalks, right? Well, that was exempted, and of course, the stalks of the marijuana plant have a lot of fiber, and that was one of the traditional uses of hemp, was rope. The problem, of course, is that you had to have imported stuff because you can't just grow seeds and stalks. But there was some residual hemp industry, and going back to the early Bush 43 administration, the DEA got really strict, and they said, you know, there's still some THC in there, and we've independently said THC is as bad as marijuana, the plant itself. We're going after you. And the court said, no, 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 no. If you're below 0.3% by weight of THC, in these stalks and seeds, we're going to consider you something that is legal and not prohibited under the Controlled Substances Act. So fast forward to 2014, and this concept of industrial hemp, something that can be used as a useful product for, you know, again, the traditional use of hemp was making rope, was first enacted into law, which is something that's less than 0.3% dry weight. And it was intended to be sort of an experimental program, and this gets a little complicated, but states right away who were supposed to be administering these experimental programs started broadly interpreting it. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Typical Congress not being very precise. They authorized this industrial hemp program, but they still didn't amend the Controlled Substances Act. The Controlled Substances Act still only talked about the sterilized seeds and the stalks of the plant. And then finally in 2018, daylight comes, and along comes the 2018 Farm Bill, and the 2018 Farm Bill expands on the industrial hemp, now just called hemp program, legalization. But what it also does is it amends the Controlled Substances Act. It takes away that little exception that had been simply the sterilized seeds and stalks, and it expands that to anything below 0.3% THC, including its extracts and derivatives. Now, if you have very low levels of THC, you're not going to be getting a lot of THC out of it, but you might be getting a lot of CBD out of it. So now you have a whole industry that can produce lots and lots of CBD as an extract of this legal plant. And so everybody at the end of 2018 said, well, all right, CBD is completely legal. You know, ding dong, the witch is dead. And then the FDA came along and said, not so fast. And with that, I will hand it over to Alva.
I don't have any bad lawyer jokes, by the way. I'm not very good at that.
She only has good lawyer jokes.
Only good lawyer jokes. So, you know, as Mark said, at the end of 2018, you know, I'm sure all of you saw, you know, the flash of headlines that, you know, CBD is legal because, as you can see from the legal definition on the left, before the Farm Bill was passed, you know, you still had this ambiguity where you had CBD still as part of the marijuana definition under the Controlled Substances Act. But on the right-hand column, we now have this general category of hemp, no longer industrial hemp under those original pilot programs, but just hemp, that there was going to be an allowance both for state programs and, in the absence of state programs, a new federal overlay being administered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture that was going to allow for the production of hemp not only for research purposes, which is what it was in, under the 2014 bill, but for broad commercial purposes. So, as you can see from the definition, one of the other critical things that Congress did was to be clear that it also, you could have legalized hemp that included CBD, so hemp-based CBD, so long as it met this 0.3% THC threshold. So that 0.3% is really critical because you essentially still have a cannabis plant under either production, but if one is 0.3% THC or less, it's hemp and legal and not part of the Controlled Substances Act. However, if it's more than that, then it goes into the big bad controlled substance Schedule I land that Mark was talking about. But, you know, everybody is focused, as you would imagine, now on hemp. What can we do with hemp and what can we do with hemp-based CBD? So, while the federal government was clear and Congress was clear that it was removing hemp and hemp-based CBD from the Controlled Substances Act, it specifically did not change the authority of the FDA as a regulatory body to regulate hemp and hemp-based CBD under the Federal Drug and Cosmetics Act. And so immediately the FDA seized on that, and former Commissioner Gottlieb came forward and said, hey, you know, everybody's real excited about this, big hoopla, but hold your horses. You know, CBD you know, it's still something that we don't know a lot about, and they don't know a lot about it because it used to be a controlled substance. So you couldn't just go out and research it in the way that you could research other sort of normal ingredients, because you're dealing with a drug, and for, you know, reasons I think all of us can understand, that's a much more highly regulated process. You have to be DEA certified lab, you know, all these things. So Commissioner Gottlieb came forward and said, you know, look, we're going to try to find a pathway forward, you know, for all of you folks, because we understand the congressional intent that in passing this bill that you wanted to open up this market, but we take our responsibility seriously as a public health organization to see how, what we think and how we feel about putting CBD in particular, regardless of whether or not it's hemp-based or not, into food and beverage products, having it be marketed as a drug, have it be marketed as a dietary supplement, and reminded everybody that, you know, as of that day, which was a year ago, that, you know, they had not authorized CBD into any of those products. So just as some general background on you know, sort of the FDA world, is that when the FDA is looking at any kind of addition to a food product, whether it's CBD or, you know, or some other ingredient, and again, this would encompass alcohol beverages, because while, you know, everybody in this room is mostly used to dealing with the TTB, the reason that you're dealing with the TTB is not because the FDA doesn't have jurisdiction over alcoholic beverages, because we are a food and beverage product. It's because there's been a long-standing memorandum of, it's called a memorandum of understanding between the FDA and TTB, formerly ATF, that said, look, you know, we don't need two agencies regulating these things. We're going to give TTB primary jurisdiction to deal with, you know, marketing and labeling and formula approvals and things like that. However, we're going to continue to work together, and there are instances, and this has become one of them, where TTB does, has, and will continue to rely on the expertise of the FDA as a you know, fairly informed government agency to help it understand what can be included in food or beverage products. So, you know, from an FDA perspective, anything, if you have an approved drug, meaning something that the FDA has recognized as an approved drug, you cannot, under the FDNAC, which is the Federal Drug and Cosmetic Act, put that substance into a food and beverage product. That is, and that's in contrast to sometimes what are known as GRAS, or generally recognized as safe additives or additions, that if the FDA has found something to be GRAS, that those can be included in food and beverage products. So, again, sort of going back to a year ago when the 2018 Farm Bill was passed, FDA came out and said, you know, hey, let's be really clear about this, that from our perspective, that we haven't recognized CBD as GRAS at this point. And also, as we'll see on one of the next slides, we do have a CBD approved drug. And so putting those two things together, you really cannot, under the Federal Drug and Cosmetic Act, put CBD into a food or beverage product or market it as a dietary supplement, which, you know, it's sort of in contrast to what we're all seeing in the marketplace, which is a whole lot of CBD being marketed as a dietary supplement, despite the fact that the FDA has been clear, consistently clear, that they do not recognize that and that it's disallowed under federal law. And then lastly, that, you know, going back to Mark's points about stalks and seeds, there have been elements of the cannabis plant which have long been excluded from the definition of marijuana because they don't have the sort of the THC or the CBD components to them, the hemp seeds and hemp seed oil, that there has been a recognition that those elements of the plant are GRAS, and so they can be included in food and beverage products. So, like I said, one of the key things to understand as to why the FDA has is justifying its position that you can't put CBD into a food and beverage product or market it as a dietary supplement is that CBD was recognized in the drug Epidiolex as a approved drug under the Federal Drug and Cosmetic Act. And that was, you know, I think that was like in 2016 or something like that. And it was primarily drug recognized for use in seizures for children, right? So, you know, it does have a medical use, but, you know, you have a situation, as with any approved drug, where, yes, there were some there was some testing for side effects for use of the CBD as part of some of those clinical trials. However, you know, the threshold of the benefit of CBD and Epidiolex for treating seizures was seen as, you know, greater than the downsides, and so it was approved. But that has created an impediment under federal law for the use of CBD for other purposes because it is a recognized drug. The other thing that the FDA was clear about in sort of talking initially about what their enforcement priorities were going to be going forward, because there was a recognition at that time, and it's certainly become more and more true as time has gone on, is look, we've got a whole marketplace of CBD products out there. And, you know, back to, you know, a government agency, limited resources, where are you going to be focused in those efforts? And consistently from the beginning, the FDA has said, we're mostly concerned with what are called over-the-line claims, which are products, primarily dietary supplements, but it could extend to any kind of food and beverage product, where you've got labeling or marketing that says, if you take this product, all these wonderful things are going to happen to you. You know, so if you're out there saying, you know, take my CBD beverage, it's going to cure cancer, you know, all your troubles are going to go away, you know, those types of products were going to be at the top of the list for federal enforcement, because candidly, you know, those are the ones that if somebody really believes those claims are sort of the most at risk for what they think they're gonna be receiving. So again, you know, this slide I think is just sort of summing up what I've been saying, which is because of the Epidiolex passages as a drug, that CBD has not been approved. The FDA also, you know, largely in the beginning after the Farm Bill was passed, kept beating the horn of Epidiolex, you know, and sort of the drug component. But in some more recent warning letters, which we'll talk about in a second, they've also been clear that CBD, because it's not an approved food additive, that that's kind of another problem with putting CBD in a food and beverage product, because it makes it unsafe and adulterated, which is sort of a different set of issues under federal law. So just giving, you know, FDA putting some more weight out there, as I think it's been under a lot of pressure, particularly from members of the Congress, to say, hey, look, you know, our intention, yes, we reserved these responsibilities to you, but we kind of thought you were going to get going on finding a solution. And my perspective is that the FDA really has been doubling down to a certain extent in light of that that pressure to maintain a position from then through today that it's not changed its mind about the use of CBD in these various forms. And also, we've got a slide up on this later, is that, you know, as you would imagine, a lot of states have a lot of deference to the FDA. You know, it is an agency that, for the most part, kind of knows what it's doing. And so there's a lot of state health associations and related boards that say, you know, look, we're going to follow what the FDA says, in ways that, you know, even alcohol beverage laws do the same thing, which will say, you know, we have our state laws, but we're going to defer to the federal, you know, Alcohol Administration Act to sort of give us a backup, because we want to be consistent between state law and federal law. So when I'm dealing with clients, and Mark and I are dealing with clients, you know, they say, hey, that's great, you know, thanks for letting me know what the law is, you know, and I hear you, it's illegal, but what's the big deal? You know, you've got all these products out there. You know, you walk down any street, pretty much anywhere in America right now, and you got a CBD store, you know, and you got folks who have CBD beverages out there and lotions and sort of all manner of things. How can that be? How can it be that you've got this, you know, really robust marketplace for a product that you're telling me is completely federally illegal? And I think the answer candidly to that is that folks feel like the enforcement is just not there. So let's talk about what the enforcement has been. To date, you know, as I was saying before, the FDA has been focused and was focused initially on those companies that were making those really outrageous health claims, that were putting products into the market, that were saying, if you take this product, all these wonderful health benefits are going to flow to you as a result. And the mechanism for the FDA to enact that enforcement so far has been warning letters. So they started kind of slow, and frankly, they've actually been stepping up their efforts where they started, you know, kind of with a few companies, you know, really going hard at that. And then there was a break. I think those first warning letters came out like in the springtime last year. But then in November of 2019, all of a sudden you got 15 warning letters. And those warning letters basically say, we've looked at your social media, we've looked at your websites, you know, it's almost exclusively internet-based research. So, you know, they're not actually going onto shelves, into stores, pulling physical labels. They're doing their research, you know, from the comfort of their computer to say, you know, we found these products and we see that you're making these claims. You need to get back to us and tell us, you know, what you're going to do, which essentially is you're going to take the products off the market. And for the most part, it's ended there. So a lot of companies, I feel like, are saying, look, you know, I'm a little guy, you know, the FDA is really, you know, they're worried about these big bad players that are saying these really, you know, elaborate things about what's going to happen. And, you know, I'm not full blasting what I'm doing and being really careful with my labeling, things like that. And, you know, I think as with anything, you're dealing with an enforcement risk paradigm. But, you know, the truth is FDA is still out there. And also, there's other folks who are getting involved in this. So, for example, at least one of the companies for which FDA issued a warning letter was a public company that it's got a shareholder derivative suit that said, hey, look, you know, now my shares are going to be depleted because, you know, the FDA is coming after this company. There's also now been a beginning of what I think is going to be, you know, a continuation of plaintiff's class action suits around folks, not about the FDA warning labels, but about the fact that in the absence of FDA regulation, there's no standard, there's no approval that says if you say this this product has this dosage of CBD in it, that and that's actually verified, that pretty much you can say anything. There's no regulations, and so there's starting to be class action lawsuits filed in, you know, your home state, which is a wonderful state for plaintiff's attorneys, which says, you know, you said the dosage was XYZ on the label, but when you test it, it's actually something much, much less than that. So yes, from an FDA perspective, you know, we have some indications about where they're focusing efforts, and you can kind of back roll out of that if you're really an eager beaver about getting into this very hot market right now. But there are other factors to consider about how that could be a risky endeavor. So again, you know, as I said, this the FDA really, instead of being at a place a year after the passage of the 2000 Farm Bill to have identified, you know, even what they originally said, which was, you know, a pathway forward for the ability to have lawful CBD, it seems like they are just continuing to dig in, but they're at least continuing to dig in ways that they're trying to be more open and transparent with the public about where their concerns are coming from. And one of the drivers, as I noted earlier, is them saying, hey, look, we just don't know. We just don't know enough. We have not had the advantage of enough studies to tell us, like, what can CBD do for you? What are the related side effects, even if, let's say, it does relieve your stress, or it relieves your stress to a certain level, or relieves your anxiety to a certain level? What are those side effects? So in those last round of warning letters, and as part of their campaign, they have an ongoing FAQ that they put up on their website that kind of outlines FDA's position on cannabis and cannabis-related products, is that they're saying, look, you know, we're getting information that it could be harmful to you. It could harm your liver, that came from those Epidiolex studies. But also that, you know, when you mix CBD with other drugs, you know, alcohol, for example, you're gonna get more drowsy. You know, what does that look like? Also that there's other side effects that maybe you're not noticing. So, you know, they're referencing things like gastrointestinal distress, changes in mood, people, you know, reporting that they're more irritable taking these products. And also, again, just FDA saying there's a lot of unknowns, like what happens with certain, like, special populations, children, the elderly, pregnant women, animals, and also just how these things are counteracting with each other. Like, if you drink a CBD beverage, you put on a CBD oil, you know, what does that look like? And so, again, FDA is coming forward and they are being clear, but sort of emphasizing this point because, you know, I hear from clients all the time, oh, well, you know, I'm hearing rumors that the FDA is, you know, just about ready to, you know, issue some really great guidelines about how you can lawfully put CBD in a food and beverage product. And, you know, unless I'm just totally out of it, I don't see it. So I think that's where we are, and that's where we are kind of for the foreseeable future. But the problem with that is that while I have a lot of understanding and respect for what FDA is doing, we do have an active marketplace that, you know, is unregulated, and there's some danger in that. So like I mentioned, and this is sort of where in the wonderful world of cannabis, you have these very strange, quirky things going on where you've got the feds taking one kind of a position, but you've got some states sort of under their own sovereignty saying, hey, look, we hear you, you know, but we're going to make a different decision. And so here, just as a contrast between California, obviously where we are, and Colorado, California, despite the fact that you have legalized adult use cannabis, has come out and said, we are going to, for this particular instance, we are going to follow the FDA's guidance and not allow CBD in food and beverage products, because we've always deferred to the FDA in this regard. We don't see a reason to change it here, even if we've made some different decisions about adult use marijuana products. And you can contrast that with Colorado, which, you know, big surprise, said, hey, you know, feds, we get where you're coming from, but we are going to affirmatively allow CBD to be put in food and beverage products. We're going to put some barriers around it, right? We're going to make sure that it meets that legal definition of hemp. It is 0.3% THC or less. You need to make sure that hemp is coming from a true hemp-compliant source. You know, it's being grown under the 2014 programs or the 18 programs when they start to come online. And also that, you know, Colorado has some labeling requirements, clear that whatever that product is, that it hasn't been, you know, tested and evaluated as safe by the FDA. now, you know, to TTB, right? Everything that, you know, we care about in this room is, you know, producers of hard cider. You know, and some of this is just sort of some important, you know, reminders about CBD and cannabis, but just in general, you know, and first is that any type of unconventional ingredient that you want to put into one of your ciders, even if it's something that is only made, you know, at, you know, your individual, you know, farm or tap room on site and isn't being sold out of state, i.e. in interstate commerce, it still requires a formula approval, you know, and that's in contrast, you know, to the COLA, the label approval that, you know, in some instances you don't need that COLA approval. And so, you know, again, I think it's probably no surprise, but TTB has been clear from the beginning that they're not gonna allow alcohol, and they're not gonna approve an alcoholic product that has THC in it, right? And frankly, sort of have conversations with folks, you know, if I had a crystal ball, I don't really see there being a world in which you're gonna be able to combine THC and alcohol together in a product, really probably ever. But TTB has also been clear that if we're talking about a grass product, right, those generally recognized as safe, that those are in a different kind of carve out and that it's gonna take a different position with relation to that. So, you know, so we go good news, bad news, right? So good news is if it is one of those kind of carve out pieces of the cannabis plant that has been recognized as, or generally recognized as safe, or grass, which are the hold hemp seed, their protein powder, the oils, things like that. Because the FDA has recognized those as grass, the TTB is following along and will allow for those products to be placed into alcoholic beverages, including hard ciders, so long as you comply with the hemp policy, which we'll talk about on the next slide, which is still formula approval. But, you know, if you jump through the hoops that TTB puts in front of you, those types of products can be put out to market. So if and there are, as Mark mentioned, there are a number of beers out there. You know, most recently New Belgium put out the Hemperer, which is a product that includes these types of, you know, hemp recognized as safe products, not CBD, that has been approved by TTB, and that's why it's been able to, you know, be put in to a full marketplace. So good news. Bad news is that when it comes to CBD, TTB has said, again, kind of like California, we're gonna amend our hemp policy, which has been in place since 2014, and say, along with the FDA, that if it's CBD, even if it's hemp-based, even if it has that 0.3% or less, unless you, producer, can come to us with approval from the FDA, we are not, TTB, going to approve your formula that contains that CBD. So they are, you know, the two agencies, TTB and FDA, are aligned in that, you know, CBD, regardless, cannot be put into an alcoholic beverage. You know, also, I think it's important to remember that, you know, as kind of a corollary to that, that has less to do with the ingredients, but more to do with marketing and labeling, is that, you know, there are rules on the books for TTB when they're looking at COLA approvals, you know, that do have restrictions about references to controlled substances, and so people trying to get creative either with imagery or with words that might suggest, you know, like even if you had an approved hemp seed alcohol, TTB would push back if you were trying by your marketing and your colas to suggest that it was actually marijuana as opposed to to a lawful hemp seed or grass product, you know, and TTB kind of as it is prone to do when other agencies are prone to do, has had some sporadic enforcement and, you know, issued some cease and desist letters to folks that, you know, in fact were trying to market their products in those types of ways. So here's just kind of a wonderful overview of, like, you know, the tangled web that we're looking at when it relates to these products. So, you know, just for orientation purposes, the gray states are the states that the only thing on the books right now is medical marijuana, right? So those states have recognized medical marijuana, but not recreational marijuana, and they haven't issued laws decriminalizing the you know, sort of personal use of marijuana. And then you have the sort of dark gray states, which, you know, sort of there are fewer of them, so like North Carolina, Nebraska, Mississippi, that have not provided any approval for cannabis-related products, but they have decriminalized it, you know, recognizing that, you know, as we're all hearing in the news, that part of the current politics around marijuana is social justice reform, and so they've taken some actions there. Then you have our black states, which they have a, sort of a combination of those two categories. They have medical marijuana statutes and regulations on the book, and they've also decriminalized it. Then you have our, you know, famous dark blue states, right, which California is one, where we do have full recognized medical marijuana as well as recreational or adult use. And then you have the light blue states, which sometimes are included when you're talking about adult use states, but in DC and Vermont, really where they are is that you can't sell adult use, but you can, it's legal. So it's kind of like, what does that mean to not be able to, you know, actually, like, have, you can't have a dispensary, but you can use it. So sort of, again, completely tangled web. So thinking about some critical state law considerations, you know, that there are also instances, you know, we talked about the federal landscape, where if you are sitting in a state, those 11 states that have approved adult use or recreational marijuana, many of them have been equally stringent as they're talking about the combination of those products and alcohol to say that you can't produce under state law now an alcoholic beverage that includes a cannabis product. A lot of times you can't, even if you could lawfully, you know, as a licensee, own both, you know, a cultivating plant and also be, you know, a licensed winery or cidery, that they can't be at the same premises, you know. So they really want, even if they're not going to prohibit ownership, they want those to be completely separate locations. And, you know, there is some, and there, this hasn't really been tested yet, but, you know, there is some concern that if you are a federally licensed producer and you add on, you know, to your organization, whether directly or through individual memberships, an interest into a, again, lawful state law, but illegal federal law, or either cultivation or something that's involved in the legal cannabis market under state law, that could, if TTB wanted to get particularly aggressive, put your federal permits at issue. So, you know, again, just a bit of a mess. But, you know, having said all of that, you know, we're not just talking about random people who just want to kind of make a quick buck on the CBD market, or, you know, kind of do a rush in and wait for the cease and desist letter. We've got major players, you know, names that we all recognize that have taken public positions and public interest in this space. So, you know, Constellation Brands has long been kind of the poster child after it made first an initial investment, but then a much more substantial investment of $4 billion into Canopy Growth, which is, you know, one of the largest marijuana producers in the world, essentially. Southern Glazer has been getting into and testing distribution of cannabis products where they are legal now in the Canadian market. Molson Coors has come out with a collaboration, again, in Canada, where it is legal now, but in preparation, I think, as we all understand, for what it could look like if and when the federal government changes its view of marijuana in the states. But you have other folks, sort of the smaller guys, that are getting creative, right? We got Lagunitas that has licensed its name to the CBD and THC-infused sparkling wines. And then lots of small brewers, you know, including, it was funny, I was giving a presentation at CBC maybe 2 years ago on cannabis and beer, and somebody raised their hand and like, I don't understand. I heard that Blue Moon guy was making a THC-infused beer. And I'm like, what about that? And I was like, I don't know about that. And the guy, and he was there, actually. He's like, well, I'm here, so I can tell you all about it. But the point is that, you know, you've got people who are being creative, who are essentially making non-alcoholic THC-infused beers, which is, you know, what, I don't know how you say that, Syria Brewing is doing. So folks are trying to get creative. I mean, it's a very innovative and an industry that wants to find fine lines around it. But you know, I think hopefully the takeaway from today's presentation is that, you know, there really are a lot of landmines that you have to navigate.
Oh yeah, there are a lot of landmines out there, and my advice there is to step away from the door for a moment, take a pause, and just go crack open a cider, and if it is your kind of scene, well, light them up and smoke them if you got them. This is Rio Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Cider, we like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
Like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!